And Einstein thinks things can really happen very, very quickly. And one is limited only by your imagination and your ability to reach out to other people. So I'm going to tell you how I got interested in this and why this receptor is important. So first of all, the people that have the worst time with COVID-19 are patients that have either prior cardiovascular disease or what we call risk factors for cardiovascular disease, risk factors like high blood pressure or diabetes. And it's a real mystery why, even if they don't have overt cardiac involvement during COVID-19, why do having these risk factors make it more likely that in fact you'll die from the respiratory complications of this disease? And this really hasn't been answered at all. On top of this, certain patients actually do get cardiac disease. The heart doesn't contract as strongly in about 20% of patients. And some of the patients need to not only be on a ventilator to help them breathe, but they need to be on various machines to support their circulation. The heart just isn't working. And it's not clear what this is. Now, at first blush, you might think, well, maybe the lungs are adversely affecting the heart. And I'm sure that contributes to it to some extent. But this is way out of proportion to what the lungs are doing. So the mystery is, why is the cardiovascular system just not working very well? And there are several theories. One is that the heart directly gets infected by the virus. And it may not even be the muscle cells in the heart, because there are many other types of cells in the heart besides muscle cells. For example, endothelial cells, which line blood vessels. And they may get infected. The jury is really out on that question. The data are not clear really in either direction. And that will be settled with time and more investigation. But another theory, which is almost certainly operating, is the immune system gets totally revved up trying to fight the virus. And sometimes it's so exuberant that it actually can cause damage to some tissues. And the so-called cytokine storm that takes place during COVID-19 may be a big factor in what's making the heart not work well. On top of all of this, it turns out the blood in patients with COVID-19 clots very easily. Patients that are on dialysis often clog up the machine, and people have never seen this happen previously. It could be that within the heart and even within the brain, because there's been an increased incidence of strokes in young people with COVID-19, that this hypercoagulable blood may be actually causing some clots, and that could also be contributing to the heart problems. Well, what got me interested in this was the receptor for the virus is a protein on the surface of cells called ACE2. And what a receptor is it's something that is kind of like a welcome mat that lets the virus get inside the cell. So even if heart cells aren't infected, let's talk about something that is, like lung cells. No question, this virus causes pneumonia. So this receptor called ACE2 is on the surface of many different cells in the body, various quantities. It's more prevalent in some places than others. And because a lot of patients that have heart disease are on ACE inhibitors, like various drugs to treat high blood pressure and heart failure, people started to wonder what this had to do with this ACE2 protein that also does double duty as the receptor for the virus. Now, it turns out ACE inhibitors really don't affect ACE2. They only affect this other form of ACE, which is why people take them for high blood pressure and heart failure. But they can indirectly affect ACE2. And that got me to thinking about ACE2 just as an entity on its own and how it might be mediating infection, how it might be letting the virus into lung cells. Now, the same receptor is used for the SARS virus, the first COVID epidemic that took place around 2002, 2003, but people really didn't investigate in detail how ACE2 might be letting that virus in as well. So it turns out that some work done by other investigators published in the journals Science and Nature showed the structure of the ACE2 protein interacting with the virus spike protein, which is the part of the virus that touches the receptor in order to get inside the cell. And that let us look at what the contact points were between the virus and the receptor. And we were able to look at those different amino acids that make up the protein and decide which ones look like they're very important for that interaction to take place between virus and receptor. And we started to, in the lab during this period, make cells that had alterations in their ACE2 so that they either should be able to interact worse or better with the virus. And we're now studying how those interactions let the virus get in the cell in the first place. And the reason why this may be important is if you could make drugs or antibodies or something that would block the virus from interacting with the receptor, maybe you could block the virus from even getting inside your cells in the first place. And viruses can't live unless they're inside of a cell. They're not like bacteria. They need to use the cell in order to further their own ends and to reproduce themselves, et cetera. So this work is actually being done with somebody that Gordon just mentioned, Kartik Chandran, who, you know, I had always known Kartik in the hall to say hi, never imagined that our paths would cross scientifically. Kartik is a luminary in the virus world. He discovered the receptor for Ebola virus. But all of a sudden, very quickly, in pure Einstein fashion, this thing kind of took on a life of its own. So our two labs are working very closely together. And we're just in the middle of figuring out what it is about this receptor. And an interesting spinoff is that it turns out some of the amino acids that we think are important in the interaction of the virus and the receptor, they actually vary among human beings. You can look online at different databases and you can see that there's some genetic variation. Not everybody's ACE2 is the same. So we're also doing a genetic study with John Greeley to look at patients that have actually gotten COVID and recovered versus ones that have been infected with COVID and have had, you know, either gone on to need a ventilator or have actually died and have done worse. And we're wondering if that correlates with the flavor of the ACE2 receptor that that patient has. Because if we could find a connection within the patients, we might actually be able to explain it in the studies that we're doing with Kartik in the laboratory to understand who is at risk for getting this in the first place. So I know I've said a lot of things that you don't think about every day. I can stop here and answer any questions that you might have or discuss any part of it that I need to clarify. But thank you for listening to this.
So Rick, thanks. So basically the spike protein is the key. ACE2 is acting as the lock, and you guys are trying to figure out which key fits best into which lock in the genetics study, and whether or not there's a way to develop therapeutics to interrupt the ability of the key to get into the lock to open up the cell to allow the virus in. So that's actually great work, and kind of builds on, again, as you point out, the expertise of several groups of investigators here at Einstein. I know that there have been a couple of questions that have come up regarding treatments that people are taking for cardiovascular disease and how they should manage that. So you pointed out that people who have high blood pressure, people who have heart failure, take these ACE inhibitors or and other medicines called ARBs. Do we know anything about how those drugs might actually influence one's ability to be infected and how they might do after infection?
That's a great question, and it's something that is what first captivated all the cardiologists watching all of this happening and learning for the first time that ACE2 is a receptor for the virus. Who would have thought that? So the jury is really out in terms of whether ACE inhibitors are will block the infection or make the infection worse. So there was one paper that led the country of Spain to take everybody off of ACE inhibitors that were on them. We did not do that in the US. And as I say, there's some data that suggests that they may actually decrease infection. Now, if they're affecting infection, it won't be by the drug directly going to ACE2, because the drugs are really against ACE1, which is in the which is somewhere else. But indirectly, it could be affecting ACE2. And that's one of the most important questions to answer, because as we all know from Dr. Fauci and experience with other viruses, there's likely to be a resurgence of this in the fall or the summer. And we have to know whether patients should be on these drugs or not.
Great. A corollary to that, is there anything that you know of specifically that people should be doing to, quote unquote, protect their hearts in light of the potential for resurgence, or in fact, in those people who have not been infected but might be at risk to get infected?
I think that's a great question also. And I've wondered whether, many of us take aspirin, which you know, baby aspirin a day, 81 milligrams. And the evidence for that, as you know, as a cardiologist as well, and as some of you on the call may know, it's pretty accepted that an aspirin will decrease the incidence of cardiac events. But when you go back and look at the original epidemiological data, the Boston Nurses Study done in the 70s, there was decreased cardiovascular disease, but there was increased bleeding, as you would expect for people on when they put many, many, many people on aspirin. I still feel that I wonder if the reanalysis in the COVID era, given the amount of coagulation that's taking place, could shift the balance even more to taking aspirin. Now, I'm not sure whether you would really make this recommendation across the board, given the fact that the elderly are more likely to bleed from their stomach if they're on aspirin. But certainly if there are cardiovascular risk factors, I would be taking an aspirin a day.
Great. So you talked a little bit about the environment at Einstein and running into people and talking about science with people. Can you give us just a little bit of an idea of what you were working on before and how, and whether it relates to the work that you're doing now on COVID-19?
I'd be happy to. So I'm one of those clinicians who got basically seduced by science. I was doing cardiology and I got interested in cell death. First, as it relates to the heart, heart attacks and heart failure. Cardiac cells die. And my lab was lucky to be able to play an early role in developing that field. And that's what I still do now. And perhaps this will all circle back on the virus causing various forms of cell death. I'd like to believe that. But I think the more interesting story is the fact that it's really hard to turn a ship kind of 180 degrees. And we're certainly not going to stop doing what we're funded to do by the NIH and the projects that have been going on in the lab. But I really do believe at a deep level that in many institutions, somebody couldn't just pick up one day and be moved by seeing all of the tragedy taking place in the city and watching the news and say, I want to do something about this. Because this requires colleagues that are very generous, that will educate you. You have to do it yourself, but to some extent, the only way to make something like this happen is kind of the collaborative atmosphere that we're lucky to enjoy at Einstein. So I could just imagine that at some other places, you might call up a virologist and say, hey, I have a great idea. Let's get together and do this together. And you may not get such a warm reception. And it was exactly the opposite at Einstein, and I'm not surprised by my experience, because that's kind of how people operate. We're very lucky to have this environment. I'm not sure how you create it. You're just happy when it exists.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Rick. I think the collaboration is the thing that actually makes this possible, and we actually are setting up these so-called collaboratories now to make it even easier for people who are interested in this topic, regardless of what they were doing before, to get involved and to work with others who have different areas of expertise to make this all happen. So what do you view as the areas that are the most likely to produce something in the short term, and that if somebody were interested in supporting COVID-19 research at Einstein, what would you suggest that someone who is interested target as an area of research?
Well, I think it's really important to do the things that are going to help in the short run, and maybe even in the long run, like remdesivir, as you were talking about before, and the development of serological therapies. But the two things that are really most likely to move the needle are a vaccine, which is obviously a huge undertaking, and drugs that will somehow interfere with the virus. And it's great when there's an existing drug. So remdesivir was made for Ebola, and it didn't even work that well for Ebola. But it's having an effect, as you've heard, I'm sure, on the news, from decreasing the number of days of hospitalization. It may sound like a very modest effect, but it's a starting point for the development of potentially new drugs. But what I would say to the group is, what's really going to possibly move the needle on this thing that doesn't seem to be going away and could be with us really for years? And the reason why I say that for years is, unlike eradicating smallpox, smallpox doesn't have an animal reservoir. It basically was in people. And once everybody was vaccinated and there was herd immunity, smallpox ended in about 1977. But this has an animal reservoir, as you know, including bats and camels and civets. And so it's not going to be eradicated. It's going to be controlled. And we want to control it to a level that we can have a normal life. So I think understanding the basic biology of the virus and how it interacts with its cells is a way to understand what the Achilles heels are of the virus and how you can target it and prevent it from causing its damage. And making a vaccine, obviously, would be a home run. And I hope that the Oxford or one of the other vaccines really is going to be online in the next year or so. But, you know, it's very difficult to make a vaccine, and there's been very few vaccines that have been made using, you know, against RNA viruses like this. But having said that, I think that it may not be as kind of immediately appealing to support the basic research, but I really think it's most likely to give the most bang for the buck. And if you look back to HIV, that's basically the model you can look at. When AZT came online in about 1996, that was all they had, or 1986, that was all they had, and it didn't work that well. But the understanding that came from it led to future generations of drugs that now makes it that you can live almost a normal life with HIV. It'd be great if there was a vaccine for that as well, but that has proven difficult. But many people are living their lives with HIV and are coping with it. I would hope that we could understand this virus, which has so many twists and turns that seem unexpected, as well as we need to make rational therapies against it.
Great. I think you're right, Rick. Understanding the basic biology of the virus will not only enable treatment and perhaps prevention of what is this virus that causes COVID-19. But I think if we look at our recent history, about every 5 years, we are affected by some viral disease that actually jumps host to humans. Fortunately, until now, it really hasn't caused worldwide pandemics like this one. But I think understanding the fundamentals, understanding how to make serologic tests, understanding how to streamline the production of vaccines will stand us in good stead as we face the inevitable future, which is, again, more infectious disease that we don't anticipate that we will have to deal with as they come along. So what I'd like to do now is just close and by thanking Dr. Kitsis for actually being with us today. And thank you all for attending. And I'll remind you that we will have, again, another In Conversation series next week when Dr. Yaron Tomer, who's the department of our chair of medicine and who basically on the clinical front lines has been the general, will be speaking to us about the clinical care experience of patients who've got COVID-19. So to everybody on the call, thank you again for joining us. Stay safe, and we'll speak to you again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks everyone for your patience as we got the number figured out. As Dean Tomaselli mentioned, we'll have a call next week. It will be on Thursday, so stay tuned for that invitation with the right call-in number. So thank you all, and have a great weekend.
Bye-bye.
Bye.